I think your tattoo was.
Oh, fuck. You're going to get it
no,
right.
No, I'm not. No, it. I'm not.
Yeah.
Is it
yeah,
from Rent?
Yes!
Shut the fuck up.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, y'all. The podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It's me, Eric Williams. And this week we've got Dylan Marin, author of Conversations with People Who Hate Me. I feel so lucky that he did this podcast amongst his crazy press tour for this book. Like, how cool is that? He was on national television doing some big old interviews, and he took a full hour to chat with me. And this conversation is it, y'all. I feel like he can be the next gay Brené Brown, if that's okay to say. I mean, the conversation's like, it's like swimming in a natural lake by a waterfall with your best Judy. Do you know what I mean? It's like calming, giggly, everything you want and more. If you notice a little southern twang in my voice, it's because I'm recording this from Atlanta, Georgia, where, you know, I really like to immerse myself in the language. I'm actually here, though, for a very sad reason. Matt's grandfather passed away, so we just had the funeral this week, and I was so happy to be with the family, and of course, so deeply sad that he passed, but I wanted to honor him in this episode by telling a little story about him. And I'm sure this southern grandfather can only picture his highest honor of being talked about in a podcast called That's a Gay Ass Podcast, but I digress. What you should know about this man is that all of the family called him Big Daddy. That was his name, you know, all the grandfather names we hear across the board. When you hear Big Daddy, you already get a picture. And Big Daddy is that picture. Tall, southern gentleman, booming personality, and just a magnetic guy. And the story I want to tell about him is that there was a tradition that I found out in Matt's family is when someone got married, the groom would always receive from Big Daddy a pair of monogrammed undies. And this was known for many, many weddings. I mean, I went to my sister-in-law's wedding, and sure enough, her husband, Cody, he received a pair of monogrammed underwear at the rehearsal dinner. And so naturally, I thought to myself, gosh, I don't know what's going to happen during our wedding. I mean, will I receive the underwear? Will only Matt? I mean, I don't think there's ever been two grooms in Matt's family to get married. At least I don't think so. Can you imagine there's like a line of gay southern people I don't know about? Hopefully not, because I want to be special. So we get to the wedding weekend, and no one really knew how it was going to go down. The rehearsal dinner comes, and sure enough, Big Daddy stands up to make a speech. And the anticipation in me is rising. I think to myself, am I going to be snubbed? And he was only welcoming and gracious and lovely to me. I always felt like a part of the family, truly. I'm not just saying that because he passed away. I'm saying that because it is true. Matt's grandparents, all of them, his whole family, make me feel so welcome, and we're very lucky for that, that both sides of our families are completely embracing of us. But nonetheless, I didn't know. And so Big Daddy stands up, and he talks about the tradition of giving the groom underwear. And he says, but today we have two grooms. And so I've pulled out two pairs of monogrammed undies, and we both stand up. He hands us both these gorgeous white boxers with our initials on them, white undershirts as well. And I'm wearing them right now. I'm kidding. But I, of course, got a little emotional. I mean, it was not only just a high-stress weekend, but to see that symbol and to feel so included and to change the tradition to welcome me into the family, it meant so much, and I think it gives you a small look into who Big Daddy was. Now, we're about to get into this episode with Dylan Marin, and I want you to check out his book, Conversations with People Who Hate Me. It is so good. He basically reaches out to the trolls or the people who sent some hate comments to him online and talks with them and tries to find some common ground. It is funny, it is encouraging, it is smart, it is uplifting, and I really think you're going to love it. Do me a favor, when you hear that sound cue that goes wah-ah-ah-ah-ah-ah-ow, hit that subscribe button for me or that follow button, and tell a friend after you listen to this podcast that you like it. I'm loving that we're growing our listenership. And follow the Instagram at gayasspodcast. Follow me at Eric Wills. And our Patreon is patreon.com/gayasspodcast for bonus Fs. The music's about to come up, y'all, so you know what to do and press that button. Gotta love you, Thay Mitch. We're both wearing our hats. We're both...
I know, mask, high mask.
We're giving high mask. Do you find that you feel like a different person when you're wearing a hat versus when you're not?
I think the hat offers up a fantasy, and it also offers up the convenience of, I don't want to think about my hair today. I love my hair, but I'm going to tuck her away. It's a tuck.
It's like, it's giving Drag Race, not untucked, it's giving, you're going to tuck her. I think that your hair is stunning. I wish I had your hair. And I think my hat for me gives me that security of, I don't need to have that insecurity out in the world. And it's not like I'm devastated about my hair day in and day out, but I found myself yesterday like trying to record a video, and then I was like, the hair is giving me pause. It's giving me devastation. And then the hat changed my day.
Yeah, it changes the day. I also have to say, you know, the fleeting things that people say to us in our childhood stay with us forever.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend, bragging, in musical theater day camp when I was 13 years old, said I look cute in a hat. So
how old were you when she said that?
13.
So it has carried you however many
years. 20 years.
20 years. I'm going to call her Stacy. I think Stacy gave you the gift of a passion for hats. But you did kind of skim past an important comment there. Musical theater camp.
Musical theater day camp, which is like a really specific subset of kids who don't yet feel comfortable leaving home, but need to go towards the arts.
They will not sleep over, but they will do Pippin.
Yes! They will not sleep over, will do Pippin, and that's my tattoo. No sleepovers, yes to ragtime.
Oh my god, the people call it ragtime, and now I'm sleeping in my own bed. Do you remember any of the shows you did at musical theater day camp?
Any of the shows. I remember every single one of the shows. I'll give you my resume, honey. Okay, so... first year I did, this is when, so you had a major and a minor, which also felt like very college.
For day
and
so the camp first year especially.
I did it, yeah, the first year I did it, I was 10 years old, and my major was video, and my minor was junior chorus. And the big show we did at the end was Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh my god.
And, yeah, it's so good.
It's so good. You gave me an instant flashback to when I was a freshman in high school. We went to the Thespian Conference in Missouri, and it was like,
okay,
you know,
she's bragging
about going to Southeast Missouri State to a huge auditorium where, like, of course, all these theater groups from high school would go from across the state to wherever we were, and all state musicals or main stage musicals were like a school would be picked to do their musical on the main stage for the entire conference. It was a big deal, and they would bring their high school musical, and the first one I ever saw was Bye Bye Birdie from some random school in Missouri, and to me it was Broadway. To me it was giving the Super Bowl of theater, because their sets lit up, the talent was so good, and as like a 14-15 year old seeing high school students be so good, I was like, this is, no one's better than this, no one will ever. And then the conference, you know what, when I haven't thought about this since then, but when I look back on it, I probably was also subconsciously knowing I was surrounded by so many gay people and not being out myself. It was probably because my high school barely had any out gay people, but just like any like gay-facing, gay-seeming people. Yeah. It was like a pretty jock-heavy school. And so seeing so many queens, I think I was like getting a taste of what the future could look like.
I know. It does offer a glimpse to the future. The funny thing is, like I said, this musical theater day camp is such a subset that there weren't a lot of out girls like us. Mm-hmm. I'm including myself. Like, nobody was out. And I remember actually whispers of people who were gay were, like, I don't know, the homophobia was strong there, and I propelled by some of the people who then later came out as gay themselves.
Of course. I always find it interesting, especially in those types of worlds when there is still homophobia, when, like, it's just, you know what it is? Kids will be kids, I think, and, like, even if you're doing the gayest thing possible, which is put on a production of Bye Bye Birdie, and you're, like, you're still, it's like, oh, did you hear that person's gay? It's like, babe, we all are.
Yeah, totally. And I also think that, like, obviously times have changed so much, and it's probably such a different, I mean, that specific place is probably so different, but this was late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And so that it was just a different time. Eminem reigned supreme, and it was like, it was just a different culture.
Yeah, Eminem really hated gay people, didn't he?
Yeah, that was like his platform for a bit.
Which,
like, his thing.
He was like, my thing is hating a group of people. I went to a theater camp that I do not want to make you feel ostracized, but it was Sleepaway.
I did.
But of course, don't worry, I call my mom crying every other day.
Yeah, good.
So I remember the same feeling of, like, no one being out, but I was like a young teen, and one of my regrets looking back is, like, I wish I could have had my first, like, boy moment, or, like, I remember this guy. I think I'm gonna say his name because it's truly been like 20 years. Quentin from Canada. I know Canada's a big place, but if you're listening, Quentin, the most endearing thing he said to me is he said, "Hey, do you listen to Boyons?" I was like, "Are you talking about Beyonce?" And he was so cute, and clearly we were both gay, but, like,
yeah,
we didn't have the tools nor the language.
Yeah.
And I regret, like, not taking advantage of that.
I know that is the sad thing that we queers miss out on often, is that kind of, like, regular old, like, we're teens and we're dating and we're flirting, and so you, like, speed up when you hit your 20s.
100%.
And then it feels like too warp speed sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes you just want to have that, like, that first kiss, and then, like, really, like, luxuriate in that, and next thing you know, you're like, wait a minute, I'm married with 4 children. Wait, speaking of, you and your husband could not be a cuter couple. I have to tell you, anytime I see a picture, I'm like, god damn, these people are. And, like, I again brag, like, I am married and proud of it, but I look at you and I'm like, no, these are goals.
No. We're all goals. Single people are goals. Yeah, no, I love him so much. See, you know, it's funny how little there is to say about positive things. Mm-hmm. It's just like,
oh my god, yeah.
I love him. Well, no, I think that's not true. I want to amend that. We find the negative so much more entertaining.
Yes.
So we say that. And I think the positive is really beautifully boring.
You're right.
And the truth is, like, I love him. Especially throughout this book process, he's always so supportive. And through this book process, I really don't think I could have done it without him. And I also feel so grateful for him every day. And, you know, this is stuff I express to him privately, but it's so funny to express it publicly because you're so trained, like, no, what we express publicly is the horrible feelings we feel.
Yeah. You know what? You saying that made me immediately think of, like, when someone asks me, like, what is new, how things are going, I immediately try to find the pithy complaint that can then be kind of snarky and funny, or like, because you're right when you say, like, if things are going well, it's like, yeah, things are good. And then, like, about 5 seconds of silence. I mean, I was talking last week with Drew Drogi about, like, when you're going to parties now, or, like, going to gatherings, and, like, especially with how long it's been since the pandemic started, of, like, socializing. And I remember I had a few people over, and someone was like, so what's new? And I thought about some of the good things happening. I thought about, like, some of the depressing things. But I was just like, And usually I can like latch onto one thing to be like, well, yeah, I, you know, went to a gay bar and this guy grabbed my ass and then I
I was just like,
things are good. And it was like devastating. Yeah.
Well, the negative is entertaining. And I also think like the negative there, we find like communal bonds by bonding through the negative. And so I think what I'm really wary of, and I also think it's like psychologically healthy to share the bad. Like it's good to be like, this is a hard thing for me and I need to express it. Great. But I worry sometimes that we obscure the good because we are trying to fit in with the edict of the public square that asks that we be as negative as possible. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I try to do that. I try to, you know, express a positive sentiment with sincerity.
Of course.
But I also know that that's sometimes too choogy for the online space.
Oh,
you
God,
know?
Chooginess. Yeah. I will say that one of the bonus episodes we have for this podcast is called This Week's Fight, where my husband and I actually unpack one of the fights we have or have
had. I mean, that's helpful.
I think so. The most recent one was, I'm going to tell you this, and I don't think he would mind. I edited out one part of the conversation where I was like, you're being a little mean. I think he was like, isn't that the point? I was like, no, I think. And honestly, it's kind of like your book and your podcast. So I'm like, no, I think it's actually to like unpack a fight and then find a common understanding or like maybe like. And I think he was just like, oh, I kind of thought we were just like fighting. I was like, fighting, no, that's like a little less fun because the conversation was about, funny enough, my driving. We just moved to LA where we're driving together for really the first time. And I'm learning that driving language is so different between anyone. I mean, do you find yourself often driving with your husband in a car?
So we just spent 4 months in LA and it was... So typically Todd is the primary driver because he's been driving since like the quote unquote normal age of like 16. And then he worked at a car dealership. So he was like really good at like hyper precision driving, you know, of like these are the newest cars. Cars are never more expensive than when they're on the lot. And so you literally cannot get a ding on it. So he cut his teeth driving those cars. And I, meanwhile, grew up in New York City, and I was like, what is a license and why would anyone ever need one? And so I got my license at 23, and then still, like, probably between 23 and 27, I think I drove, gosh, I want to say, like, five times.
Wow.
yeah
So by the time you got to LA, you were like, babe,
You. Well, the thing that changed is when I was 27, I went on this like big cross-country tour with a podcast that I was part of. We were doing a lot of like shifts of driving, and that felt better. And then in LA, I was driving every single day, and so that felt like really like it felt like throwing myself in. So I feel much more comfortable now. But yeah, he definitely feels like the driver and I the passenger until now when we are shared drivers.
So it feels like then your driving language is pretty... Does he feel safe when you're driving?
Yeah, he didn't used to. He now tells me.
Okay. Oh, see, that's the thing is like how sweet for him not to tell you that till now. Whereas my husband will grip the side of the car. He will punch at the ceiling. He will stomp at the fake brake in front of him. And I'm like, you need...
Wow.
And I had to be like, sweetie, driving with you is miserable. I'm hearing a full orchestra next to me of pounds and gasps. And
the grabbing the...
He grabs the handle. He grabs the handle. And so he came to really able to verbalize his feelings, which is that my driving is that of a straight white man who thinks that everyone should get out of his way. And I said, maybe it's because I learned from, you know, straight white men. Maybe it's because, I mean, I have three brothers who are all straight men. Like, and he says that we all drive the same, but my mom drives the same as well. It's like, and I want to make one thing clear.
Yeah,
Do not perceive myself as a reckless driver. And I'm very, I think if anything, I will drive 5 miles over the limit, which is the irony of all this. It's like, I'm like the neurotic Jew that's like, I don't want to fuck anything up.
I don't even want to get into auto friction with anyone. Friction. Emotional auto friction.
Let alone emotional. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I am like, this coming from, he's just like so grandmother that we have to add on about 7 minutes to our itinerary if he is driving, because it's just like,
that's his vibe.
And then I complain about it to his parents a little bit, because I notice some similarities between his parents, and his mom said it's the exact same thing, but his dad is the me, and his dad said to me that his mom is always reacting in crazy ways. So I think it's genetic, honestly. And we have come to more of an understanding, but all this to say, like, we are all doing what we can, and you and your husband are beautiful is the thesis statement of that. Can I ask you how you met your husband?
Yeah. Old school, through a mutual friend. Someone was like, I know someone I would love to introduce you. And we both kind of rolled our eyes separately and we're like, okay, it's just another gay person, you know. And then the honest truth is, and I'm not going to censor myself to censor the positive. The simple truth is we met and we fell very fast in love. And...
What was the vicinity of where you met? Was it like
I was doing a, I was with a theater company at the time. And
was it the Neo Futurists?
Yeah, the New York Neo Futurists.
Oh my God. First of all, I love reading that part of the book. And also I went to college in New York and lived in New York for a long time. And I saw many a Neo Futurist show.
Yes.
I might have seen you, but one of my teachers.
What years did you come?
When I was in college, my teacher, Jacqueline Landgraf, was in there.
And oh my God. Neo. Wow.
Did I see you?
I'm sure you did.
Oh my
so
God.
So I was active with them from 2012 to 2015.
I probably saw you, because I definitely started going like 2009, and then but like I went to many a show, so I'm sure I did. Did he see you in the show?
Well, I was doing, we would do like main stage shows, which was like longer form pieces. And so I was doing one at this like puppet workshop loft in Williamsburg. And so the friend brought him there and we met, and then a bunch of us all went out to drinks, and I was feeling like super confident. And I was like, hey, like, why don't you just give me your number and we can find a time to hang out? Cause he was feeling a little out of place because it was like a lot of people who knew each other. And he was like, okay, I'm here. And
and then
very
you went
fast.
Out. You went out soon after, and the rest is herstory.
It's written in the books. And
how long were you together before you got married?
2 years, 2.5 years.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with that. You knew it.
We were child brides together, and we were super young, or rather young for our friends. I think ancient for some other communities.
How old were you when you got married?
I was 27.
That's young.
26.
That's young.
It's young.
Especially for gays.
Not for some other communities.
Oh,
you know?
Of course. I mean, isn't that so interesting? Like you being from New York City is such a different world from me being from St. Louis, Missouri. It's like I have a brother who feels like he is quote unquote behind with like some life things because he is not married and boo 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 boo. Meanwhile, he's 26 or 27, and it's
I
like
know, and you're like, you are so young,
a baby, such a baby. And I think we get like trapped in what we think the like milestone should be, and it really but I do wanna talk about this gorgeous book, Dylan.
Oh my God, love it so much.
I mean, anyone listening to this, I think it should be a requirement. Conversation with people who hate me. It's like, here's what I love about it so much, is that it's not only you talking to people that, of course, you're trying to find common ground, who have said, like, pretty intensely hateful things to you about, you know, maybe gay people should not be alive. But it's also a huge look into your creative process that I was so fucking into, especially because you talk about, like, knowing when something isn't working and then the steps that you have to take in order to, like, look that in the eye and then do the pivot. Because I've told this to a few guests of just, like, how imposter syndrome affects me, and I know a lot of people, and, like, you seem to be a person that, like, okay, hi, there's a little impostery moment, now let's just, like, look it dead in the eye and then move forward and find the solution. Do you think that you have found a imposter syndrome, not cure, but, like, a thing that you do that immediately allows you to, like, acknowledge and move on? Or is it still, like, a devastating thing for you that you just have to, like, deal with?
Yeah, it's definitely still a devastating thing that I have to deal with. And it's like, I think, you know, resumes are so easy to navigate in retrospective narration. Like, I know what took me from sketch comedy in college to the New York Neo-Futurists Theater Company to Welcome to Night Vale to Every Single Word to Sitting in Bathrooms with Trans People to Unboxing to Conversations with People Who Hate Me.
Right.
Each one of those led me to the next one, and I know the very obvious path between all of them. And I think, you know, I think it's even harder than imposter syndrome. Like, imposter syndrome means, oh, I'm not who people think I am. But sometimes I don't even get to that point. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I feel invisible. You know, like, I feel, which I also understand is ridiculous, because if anyone is listening to this, then I am visible to them. And they're like, how could you feel invisible? But this is the kind of conundrum that we're all having to face on the internet, is like, you can kind of feel insignificant and like you don't matter. And like, you know, to make a podcast in the era of podcasts can just be like, okay, I'm sending this out into the ether. Like, does this matter? And yet I would never counsel a friend that. I would always say, and not fakely, I would be like, of course it matters, because like, there is no one piece of art that matters more than anything else. And I always wish I could speak to myself with the coherence and clarity that I speak to a friend.
Oh my God.
And I can't. So yeah, I mean, there are a whole host of things, but I do think it's like important to dispel this notion that I don't have imposter syndrome, because there, and yeah, there are other things I battle, like not feeling good enough, and feeling, you know, I was off social media for 13 months to write the book, because it was really impossible to have the voice of Twitter in my head while I was writing about, you know, the way that I formed bridges online. Because I don't, just as we were saying that, like, positivity is not really something that people want to hear, that's the kind of stuff that is not only ignored on Twitter, but if it's paid attention to, it's scorched, you know?
Oh, the voice and of so, Twitter, I'm sure, would have just been tearing down at any bridge you were trying to build.
Completely. And so I knew that I needed to write this book, and I knew that I couldn't have that voice in my head. And those 13 months were the psychologically healthiest I've ever felt.
Dylan, I'm jelly. Sometimes I see people that take their little breaks like that, and that's a pretty long break. And I think, like, what you say in the book too, that really resonates with me. It's like, there's just constant content. There's constant voices. Yeah. There's constant moving pieces that you feel like you need to be a part of. And yeah. I think I lately, especially, feel my engine revving and running so much that to stop the engine, even like, I forgot my phone in another room, I'm not joking, for like 12 minutes. And during the 12 minutes my phone was in a different room yesterday, I was like, wow, I didn't look for my phone for 12 minutes. And I think I was actually finishing your book, truly. And I was like,
okay, brag.
Brag. And yeah. I was like, oh my God, that felt like a nice 12 minutes or however long it was. And I... You know what I'm really trying to manifest right now is that I get to write a gorgeous book like yours or do something that forces me to be off for 13 months and like be able to justify, which you clearly could and did. And I think, what did you notice differently about like anything day to day without being on social meds?
Well, I can actually report that because this week, so since when I came back on, I had super regimented ways of being back on. Mm-hmm. I would... like basically have to sign out time in a little notebook I have that allowed me to go online. And that just meant like it was helpful to have an external notebook that I needed to like, I could even say like 10 minutes on social if I needed to post something, but then I'm not checking notifications. That all changed this week, the week I'm talking to you when the book came out, because I knew that I needed, you know, and this is not just coming from me, like, my publisher is expecting constant posting, and oh my God, it's so hard because like so to answer your question, in these last 3 days when I haven't had any guardrails and I've just been like, you know, going on going on my phone raw dog and just like on social media, I felt more nervous, I felt more anxious, and I find that, like, if something makes me anxious externally, I'll go on social media and just refresh, 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 new social media platform, refresh, 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 new social media platform, refresh, and then there's enough things to toggle back and forth with that you can feed your mind something new. And so I feel myself more agitated, and I think one of the hardest things, too, and I know other people are dealing with this, and when you deal with it, it feels like you're the only person in the world who does, is like measuring my worth and the value and quality of my book against the likes I receive on posts about it.
Oh.
And I didn't have that for 13 months. Yeah. You know, like in the quiet of my brain, which was like, still with all of the anxiety and depression, you know, like I'm still myself, right? But I'm myself without this detrimental external source. And so I really appreciated being in the quiet to write this book and to finish a chapter and be like, oh my God, I think it's done. Like, I think it's done. And then put it on a shelf and then pick it up again to re-edit it. But it just feels like a constant judgment, and I both am aware that, like, I'm embarrassed to even have that feeling. Like, I'm embarrassed that I even care about the metrics, and yet I can't, and yet that embarrassment doesn't stop how much I care about the metrics.
Of course. I mean, I think that it... anyone listening, and like me especially, would be like, the last thing you should feel is embarrassed, because if anything, we should all feel mortified by it. And then again, none of us should, because it was designed to make us feel this way, right? It was designed for us to go from platform to platform to platform. I mean, I wake up a lot of mornings and I will scroll through my platforms and be like, and then I realize I'm not getting the amount of validation I want, and I'll circle back to the first one and I'll be like, wait a minute, why? And then I would literally say to myself, Eric, you have nothing else to look at, and so do something else. And I think that it's, I have a friend who, you know, also is a creator and puts a lot of things out, and she, when I was at one of the depths of my imposter syndrome, you're not good enough syndrome, I would say to her, like, because she was constantly putting things out that were like wackadoodle. And I was like, how do you put up these wackadoodle things? Like, and she's like, you know, I just like, I post it, and then I don't let the outcome dictate what I feel about the actual work.
How?
And I was like, but how? And she just said she like doesn't really examine the metrics as much as she used to. And I think she just got practice doing it. And since she told me that, of course, I like had frustration because I was like, there's zero part of my body that can do that. But since then, I've gotten, the only way I've gotten better is that, and I've talked about this so much in therapy, is that realizing this mantra, which is, if I fail, and by failure, of course, I'm meaning like the metrics are low or that people aren't, it's not resonating with anyone, or maybe someone says that it's bad, whatever it is. If I fail, the world does not end. If I fail, the world doesn't end. And I've, of course, it's like, I think comes from my childhood too, of like being told, as long as you did your best, as long as you did your best. And I've realized, oh, wait a minute. If I do my best every single time and then anything happens that's not considered quote unquote my best, then I consider it a failure. And then I think the world's going to end because I did because you know, as long as you did. And I've had to realize like that way of thinking was really fucking up my day to day and my relationship with just creating anything. And so I think that's the only way I've gotten a little better about, like the other day I posted something that I thought I was pretty proud of, and it, you know, kind of tanked. And I said to Matt, it's like a total brag because he used to really have to talk me down a lot. I was like, look, this is kind of doing poorly. I still think it's good. And I'm not really freaking out about it. And he was just like, yeah, I mean, that's, I think he's grateful because I, especially during the peak of the pandemic where I was just like, all I had was to post and just see how it did. And then he would just be like, stop looking. Looking. And the thing that your book I always would think about too is I've talked about it a few times where I had a video on TikTok that went viral in a bad way. It went viral in the Trump community where they were all tearing me down, and they would show my video at Trump rallies and like do they would duet it or stitch it and say like basically what an idiot I am. And I found myself reading every single comment and then spiraling further. And then Matt and I like had a full on argument about it because he was like, you need to stop reading these things. Yeah. And I felt powerless against it.
Well, you know, and I do say this in the book too. And it's also, I also am hyper aware that like I have quite literally written a book about navigating this. And yet I'm still susceptible to the very things that I was grappling with in the book. But I say this in the book, which is that when I started receiving the hate that prompted the podcast, I was counseled by many well-meaning friends who love me so much to just log off. But I think that that's lovely advice in theory, impractical in practice, you know, because it's like so much of our lives are lived online. And for so many of us, our work is online too. And actually our need to post is tied to our business model and our income. And so that's really challenging. And I think that like the just don't look at it. Well, like there is a gravitational pull to negative comments that make you need to look at them because there's a sense of control you are trying to exert over those comments. And it's as you read, it's how this whole project started, because the hate I was getting was on Facebook. And so I needed to obsessively scroll through my quote unquote haters' profiles to understand who they were. And that made me feel better because then they didn't feel like distant strangers. They felt like known entities that I could potentially reach. And so this attraction we have to negative comments about ourselves is, I think the thin analysis of that is that it is masochistic narcissism, right? I think the more nuanced thing is it's actually not narcissism. It's like, how could you not? Like, how could you not? When I, you know, guests on my show, whether it's moderated, a moderated conversation where I'm hosting a talk between people, or it's me one-on-one, like so many of them are so curious about what people are saying about the episode. So it's so natural. It's so natural. I mean, if you ever wanted to make an episode about that TikTok video, I would be fascinated.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it is such a crazy journey because I made the video. It was, of course, during the election, and I made it in a way that was like I was walking down the street with Matt. We were visiting my parents in Missouri, and I was like, oh, you know, this might be a funny idea. It's a 6-second video. My husband and I holding hands, and the caption is something like, you know, two gays walk through a Trump neighborhood. And it's me holding his hand. The camera pans from our hands to me, I think. And it just me looking around going, anyone got a problem? And literally that's the video. And so what they started to do at Trump rallies is they would go, you got a problem? No. You got a problem? No. Trump is the most LGBT pro president we've ever had. And it was like, and then I was like, am I crazy? Is he pro LG? Is he good? Like, and I was like, it was such a mind fuck. But I do want to say that there is it's such a drug almost to know what people are saying about you and like to look away. It's like when people drive down a highway and you see the car accident, you see the police cars, and like that's why there's fucking traffic, because people just like craning their necks to see what's happening. But I do want to say, in the interest of time, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get back to the podcast question and more about this beer. Dylan, listen fucking up. I want to get to the famous podcast question, which is, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Angelica Houston and the Witches.
What?
And her cape specifically.
Her cape specifically? Okay, you have to know something that I've not really talked about Angelica Houston and the Witches specifically, if at all, on this podcast. And then it came up literally so recently where we were talking about why witches are so fucking gay. And Angelica Houston and the Witches was one of our prime examples.
It was the black cape with the purple lining.
Yes. The purple lining of it
and
all.
And remember when she had her gloves and she let it go and then the cape fell
down. Oh, my God. That
that's what I did it. I just want to say I woke up every single Saturday and Sunday morning for I think a year of my life to watch The Witches at 7 a.m., which was when I was allowed to start TV time.
7 a.m., you were just like jaw on the floor watching Angelica Houston's gorgeous gloves. So I wonder what your entree, I mean, like, how did I even get to know about The Witches? I think it was just like kind of canon, right? It was like kid canon.
Well, Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl, of course.
I don't want to brag, but I did read the book.
Oh,
first.
Shit, dramaturge.
Yeah, she's a dramaturge. And then I read the book, and I found out there was a movie, and it was one of those rare things where the movie, like, was what I imagined and then surpassed it. And also the poster of it, which is like the cape forming the most beautiful pattern.
I'm looking it up.
Like a beautiful wave. Oh my God. That poster die for.
I mean, it's absolutely stunning. And you know what's interesting is I didn't see the remake with Anne Hathaway, and out of kind of like fear, but this original poster, I mean, it's camp. It's honestly Angelica Houston. It's a drag queen, right? Is it disrespectful to say that? I think it's giving such costume, such size. It's like, you know, I think it would have to be dramatic with like a football field length train, right? Like it's in our DNA.
Yeah. I welcome the tradition drag of lace, you know?
Tradition drag of lace. Wait, your wedding dress for your renewing your vows. Are you going to do, what's the neckline? Are we giving sweetheart? Oh. Are we going to go strappy? What are we doing?
Gosh, I would love a strapless.
Oh, yeah.
But the truth is, you know, I know you're asking as a joke, but the funny thing is my fashion feels so basic. Like, I feel like, you know, in like Doug on Nickelodeon, how he like just wears the same thing. I'm like, you know what? I found my uniform. I found what I feel comfortable in. And it's like, not only like not breaking fashion barriers, but like not breaking like Sears mannequin barriers. You know, like I am.
The Kohl's mannequins are like, she's wearing that.
Yeah. It's like, again. Yeah.
Again? I'm in the same boat. I think we are kind of, I think this universe brought us together because I, as a gay man, I think wishing I was given the ability of alternate outfits, like a vision. I mean, Matt is especially because I'm married to someone who is so fashionable and fashion and like just like like
fashion noble
giving royalty. He like is able to put together a look that is like such a stun. It can take a risk, and then I can be like, "What about this?" And he's like, giving me a face. Wow. Like, no, yeah. no.
And I don't know that when I know a lot of people and love a lot of people who love fashion, and I'm like, oh, I don't know what you determine is a good
look. None at all. Don't know a darn thing. It feels like a science of which I can never take a class and learn the system behind, because it feels kind of arbitrary, right? Like design. And here's the thing, like people who do design, of course, in fashion, interior design, like there is such a science and a method, but a lot of it is inherent artistry of like visual. And so again, Matt has made our apartment look stunning, and like it's only because of his ability to have an eye, and I don't know where to get that.
No.
You cannot buy it.
If you give me a couch, I'll sit in it.
I will sit on that couch.
Yeah.
I will enjoy a gorgeous meal with that coffee table, and I will be watching. Yeah. I'll watch HGTV with you. Yeah. And of course, I'll give all sorts of opinions.
Yeah.
I cannot believe they used that tile. Meanwhile, I wear the most disgusting.
The same subway tile over and over again. Yeah.
Subway tile. And then in real life, I like cannot. If you were to ask me, like, design a room, I'm sure I would make it look, like, not good.
Yeah, I think I've, you know, you just, I gravitate towards the most basic stores. You know, like, give me a CB2, give me a Crate and Barrel, and you can't really go wrong.
No, you cannot.
You know?
Although,
but in terms
full
of,
circle, our couch is Crate and Barrel. Just want to let you know that, and we love her.
Our couch is Crate and Barrel, too. We love her.
Good.
Yeah. Anyway, so you just like, you can't go wrong when you point at something and you're like, yeah, I like that. But the people who are like, oh God, that's a horrible design. I'm like, what? Like, I can't.
Yeah, but why?
I don't know.
Yeah, but could you, I have no idea. Could you tell me why? Yeah.
And they don't.
And they will not. Yeah. They refuse. Well, I do want to say that Angelica Houston in The Witches is such an incredible answer. I think that witches and magic in general, we've talked about, have such a queerness and...
So gay.
Oh, I did. Did you see the Anne Hathaway remake?
I did.
Do we have a feeling about it?
I don't. I. It was so hard to compete in my mind.
Of course.
With the Angelica Houston, but I also understand that Anne can be a lightning rod of negativity that I do not want to participate in. So I'll just say the honest truth, which is that I was not as much a fan of it as I was of the Angelica.
Sure. I, in my mind, was envisioning you just then going in on Anne Hathaway as a bit. But here's the thing. I want to say she is that lightning rod of negativity, but I'm noticing a change recently where people are rebelling against the lightning rod.
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely her time. And I mean, that's
in 2014, it was at its peak.
Oh my God.
And I think now people are realizing that it was not worth it.
It was not worth it, babe. I mean, like, what her biggest crime was that she gave us one of the best movies of all time with Meryl Streep. Can we just thank her for that?
Or it was that she was just excited for her Oscar win, which is like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm guilty of complaining about her quote, "It came true." That was the one was a little tough. But listen, who am I, especially as a theater gay, who am I to say that when I accept my Oscar, I'm not going to say the most cringy, like, okay, I want you to tell me, what are you going to say that's cringy when you win your Oscar?
Can I just say something about Anne, which is, please, like, so many times I think when we react to the "it came true" thing, mm-hmm, I think so many times, not always, but a lot of times we're reacting to that quote-unquote cringiness within ourselves, that like,
yes,
there's a sense of like, I think there's a time in my life when I would have said that.
Drag
and you're trying
me
to abolish that part of yourself that would have said that. And I think the more radical and subversive thing we can do is like love that part of ourselves, even if it's no longer who we are. And just say like, I will tell you that the first tattoo I ever wanted to get, and thank God my parents asked me to think about it. I have very, like, down parents.
Wait, don't tell me the tattoo. I want to guess what the tattoo is.
I'm ready.
Okay, so you're saying that your parents are like, I want you to consider this, and we're talking about earnestness, we're talking about cringe. I think your tattoo was...
Fuck. You're going to get it right.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not.
Yeah.
Is it from Rent?
Yes!
Shut the fuck up.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Wait, so sure that I wasn't going to get it right, but also part of me knew
I
was.
I saw it in your eyes, and I felt in this space that we've created that it was right.
Dylan, we just did that. Well, now I don't want to say the quote because I can only be right from the show.
No, you already passed the threshold of correctness, so you're here. Just guess it.
I mean, I'm going between a couple. I'm leaning towards...
Yeah, say it.
No Day But Today.
That was part of it. It was Measure Your Life in Love. And then here's the kicker. Are you ready for
it? I'm ready.
And this is when I give you permission to end this Zoom and delete this recording.
Okay.
He was the really big, happy, and sad face of theater.
No, Dylan.
Beneath which it was going to say Measure Your Life in Love. Or... CCY04, which was the summer program I did.
CCY04.
And it was going to say CCY04, Measure Your Life in Love, or CCY04, No Day But Today.
Dylan, can you imagine for the rest of your life on this earth, you have a tattoo like, that talks about your summer day camp?
Every time I hooked up with someone, every time I hook up with my husband.
They're like, what is CC4? Like, what does that mean? You're like, it means, and you try to make up a different...
Yeah.
A different... Wow, I'm so grateful for your parents. I'm grateful.
I really am too. And they were down to be like, we will sign a permission slip.
Wow.
But like, it was like the best kind of parenting. That's like, we release you to make your own decision as a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
But
take a good look in the mirror, baby. Oh my God. And then you kind of like came to and you said, maybe I won't do this day summer camp on my body for the rest of my life.
So importantly, that was my first sleepaway.
So I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
But that's why, because it felt like I was like, new era.
You graduated to like a very vulnerable thing, which is to sleep away from your bed. Wow. Do you have any other tattoos?
I got a tattoo. Yeah.
What does it say? And then cut to you saying it's like the most cringy line from something else.
And it's defying gravity.
Yeah, it's actually I haven't changed for good.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I say this, but like if someone has that tattoo and loves it, like literally go off.
Go off. Mm. Oh my God, of course.
This is the outline of Prospect Park, which is the walking trail of Prospect Park. And I did that. I took my parents' advice with me into adulthood.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was like, anytime I'm thinking about getting a tattoo, I'm going to think about it for a really, really long time. And so I had wanted this for 8 years. And I think the thing is, like, I've walked the loop of Prospect Park at my highest highs, at my lowest lows, in depressions, in celebrating good news, in processing something. Like if I record something for myself that I'm trying to write and I don't totally see the pieces, I'll walk around the loop and try to process it. And that was... it felt like a sustainable thing because it wasn't just tied... Like even if I move, you know, across the country, that is still like the loop where I feel like I like became an adult.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think it's like they say we'll always have Paris. There will always be like that beautiful place.
Yeah.
And as someone who also, you know, I lived in Brooklyn for years. I feel like the depth of despair in New York, it feels different than anywhere else, I think. Like being surrounded by so many people, and I think also like the buzzing energy of the city. And also, as someone who has commitment issues when it comes to a tattoo, for that very reason of I have to really think hard about what I would want on my body for so long. I think something that has that depth of meaning to you, that's also rooted in a real place and such specific symbology, I think is fucking cool. And that is actually a really good criteria, I think, to get a tattoo, because when you do something that is from such a specific point of time that's pointing to one specific reference of a specificity, you wonder how that specific moment will change in your rear view in 1, yeah. 2, 5, 10, 20, 30 years. Yeah. And that's what makes me nervous. But I love that tattoo you have.
So one, it's simple. And two, I don't, like, I haven't posted about it, which kind of feels helpful, because it was like, I had to be like, this is just for me. I actually didn't tell Todd about it.
Wow.
Like, I mean, he knew for years the tattoo I wanted to get, but when I made the appointment, it was literally, it's like, you know how doctors are like, that's a decision between you and your doctor, you know, it's like, this was between me and my tattoo artist, and I knew that I couldn't consult anyone else on should I do it, because I knew I needed to get to the place where I wanted to do it, and I did, and I'm really proud that I did it. And yeah.
I think listening to you say that you just, you, between you, God, and your tattoo artist, I get annoyed by myself for trying to get validation from others with decisions. And like, I will like literally create kind of anything and show it to Matt, seeking that validation.
Yeah.
You know, something that came up while we were talking earlier is I saw this post about, if you have these things, this points to low self-esteem or something like that. And it was kind of like getting external validation from, you know, let's say social media numbers. It was listing all these things. And I was like, check, check, check. Isn't this just like this like human condition?
It's totally a human condition. And I also think that like in that same way that you just described, you know, asking for feedback on something like before you post it. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what we do at hyperscale every day on social media.
Right.
We are posting something to be like, what do you think of this? And so then what happens is we're constantly responding to the feedback that we get and then shifting who we are to please the capricious gods of social media, which is to say the algorithm, which is a really dangerous thing, because then it creates this very weird like mono thought and like mono joke and mono sense of humor that kind of doesn't budge. And I, backstage of the book, when I finished the book, I sent it out to like too many people to be like, hey, I would love your feedback. And I think the confusing thing is when someone is asked for feedback without specific parameters of like, tell me if this chapter makes sense in context versus like, just tell me what you think. Then you're going to get a lot of people who are like, oh, I would change this. I would change this. I would change this. I would change this. They're doing that with love.
Yeah.
It's just that. Whereas it's so much more helpful if you send someone a book, you're like, this is finished. I hope you enjoy it. Then
they're not going to be like, I want you to change this. I want you to change this. I want you to change this.
But not because they're censoring themselves, but more when you're like, oh, I'm consuming a finished thing. Great. I will take this finished thing as the thing that it is. And then look forward.
I'm writing something right now that I've actively had to tell myself, when you are ready to send this out, please be choosy. Please, just knowing what effects, you know, people's opinions can have on me in that way. But speaking of opinions, this hour is flying by. I need to ask you another question, which is, if the world was ending and you can only save one character actress, who do you think you would save?
Lisa Ann Walter.
Dylan, now I'm going to be looking up Lisa Ann. Give me the pitch.
You're going to recognize her from her most recognizable
role. Oh my
She's on Abbott Elementary.
I know she is. I'm devastated I didn't know her name.
But see, that's the thing. I looked it up because I was like, Lisa Ann Warren, and actually that's a different actress. Lisa Ann Walter, she played the nanny in Parent Trap.
Oh my God, of
And
course.
There was something about her that I was just like,
do you know what?
Oh my God.
Chessie,
right?
Chessie is the... And she also, what movie that I think it was a very like gay moment growing up of just like an attachment to a movie that I think is like widely forgotten is Shall We Dance, the remake with Richard Gere and J-Lo.
Richard Gere. Yeah, I know.
I bought the movie and I just like, I think something about the ography, the language of dance, and like probably I just wanted to fuck Richard Gere. And then also this gorgeous character actress, Lisa Ann Walter, she is the moment.
She's it.
And now
she's
I just
so want
to go
good.
Into a deep dive of Lisa Ann Walter. Oh my God. I mean, anyone listening to this, if you don't, she is in Abbott Elementary. There's a clip going around right
now. Abbott Elementary is so good,
so
by
good.
The way.
There's a clip like, of hers going around right now of... I'm just starting to watch it, so I don't know any characters' names, but it's like one of the gay guys is his boyfriend comes to meet up, and he's found someone who wants to spend time with you, and then his boyfriend shows up, and he ends up being Larry Owens, a black guy, and then one of the teachers is like black, and then he goes, "It's pronounced Zach." It's so fucking funny, but Lisa Ann Walter gives the woman can land a punchline.
She's so good. She's so good. Also, you spoiled it for me. I did not know we got to meet his boyfriend, and I did not know that Larry Owens is the one.
Fuck, spoiler alert.
Larry is so good.
So good, and also, like, popping up in everything.
I know.
Oh, wow.
How lucky are we?
How lucky.
We live in this time.
Well, how lucky am I to have you on this gosh darn gay ass podcast? Oh, my God.
Thank you for having me.
If anybody has not purchased this gosh darn book, Conversations with People Who Hate Me, it is honestly, I tore through it. It's just so, so like affirming of what can happen between people who fundamentally disagree. And it's also funny. It's also like at times reading a novel because we're following your story of how you got from point A to point B. The fact that you're sitting here and I'm like, talk to you after you've written this colossally important, huge, great book. It's just, as a person who aspires to be like a Dylan Marin in my life, I was so inspired by it. And I just want to thank you for honestly writing it. And anyone who reads it is lucky to read it. And I genuinely mean that.
I could not ask for a better endorsement. Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for reading it. And also thank you for saying that. You know, like, it is like a book about a big topic, capital letters at the beginning of all of those. And I think that I get really turned off when I read a book about a big topic, capital B, capital T, that feels so dry. Mm. And so I wanted to embed it in the story that I lived so that it reads more like a story than that. So the fact that you recognize that means the world to me, and I thank you.
Oh my God, of course. And the last question I didn't prep you for before we stop record is, Dylan, what is the best Whoopi Goldberg film?
You know, too many to choose from, but I loved The Associate.
No one danced
Diane
that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And then Diane Weiss was just talked about last week too. Dylan, the synergy. Okay, wait. I don't think I've seen The Assistant. Are you mad?
The Associate.
The Associate. There we go. I'm not even listening.
Well, if last I saw it was literally the week it came out on VHS. So forgive me if the themes have not stayed, but she can't get work. She's like this very successful businesswoman, but she's, as we know, Whoopi Goldberg is, she's black. And so she pretends to be a white man to get a promotion.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's just, I just remember just like being caught in the LOLs,
And you know what? You're giving us a gift because it's rare that we get a Whoopi film that hasn't been discussed. And now I'm going to do my homework and either watch for the first time or rewatch. And that is yet another
gift.
What's
the most common one?
People are torn between Sister Act 2 and Ghost or The Color Purple. The three big are Ghost, Color Purple, Sister Act 2.
But The Color Purple, that version, like, de-gays the story.
Very good point. Whereas so, the Broadway musical doesn't.
Honey, she does not. It says this is a gay story.
It says
about gay characters.
Characresses.
Yeah, they really... Oh my God, I cannot wait to see the film adaptation.
Oh my God, I can't wait. You know what? We're going to have
Fantasia.
Fantasia fucking Barrino. We're gonna have a reunion F just so we can cry and talk about Fantasia for an hour. Well, listen, where can people follow you, Dylan?
You can follow me online at Dylan Marin across socials, or you can read my book and write me an email and tell me what it meant to you, and you don't have to follow me at all.
Oh, we love. Well, thank you for coming on, and I hope to see you again soon.
I hope so, too. Well, thank you for having me.
Friend of the Pod Productions.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.